Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I forbindelse med at Tid er penger har publisert et intervju med Espen Haug, en veldig meritert karakter som har blant annet mye erfaring fra Wall Street, så du publiserte det på vår Patreon. Tid er penger, nei, patreon.com/tid er penger. Og I den forbindelse publiserer vi et intervju vi gjorde før jul, det var I oktober. Og hun har skrevet en bok om P-bransjen, veldig interessant. Vi tror det kommer til å like det. Og sign opp på Patreon, for du hører Espen Haug. Det veldig, veldig bra.
Nå har jeg akkurat gjennomført et intervju med en amerikansk journalist, Gretchen Morgenstern, faktisk norske Ana, I området rundt Stavanger. Og hun har skrevet en bok som heter These are the Plunderers, How Private Equity Runs and Wrecks America. Hun har også vunnet Pulitzerprisen tidligere, og har finansbakgrunn I tillegg. I det här intervjuet så forteller hun litt om de mørke siden av den amerikanske private equity-industrien som de aller fleste aldri hører om. Hva du synes om intervjuet, Peter?
Ja, altså for det første så Gretchen jo ikke en hvem som helst, og, det, og du nevnte jo for så vidt Pulitzerpris vinner, så det ikke hvem som helst vi har med å gjøre. Jeg synes intervjuet veldig bra. Det kanskje, altså det balanserer litt grann av det bildet som private equity har lykkes I. Jeg må si at de har vært kjempedyktige I å lage et bilde av en industri som basically, altså hvis du tenker på det, så hvor investorene, altså hvor investorene betaler mer for mindre. Og mer for mindre mener jeg ikke at det nødvendigvis lavere avkastning, for man har fått veldig god avkastning på samme måte som man har fått god avkastning på aksjer I den perioden hvor renten var lav. Men I private equity så har du mye mindre transparent, du har ikke noe mark to market og så videre, slik at du ser ikke fluktuasjoner og daglige, ukentlig eller månedlig for den saks skyld, verdsettelse på porteføljen. Så egentlig så investorene veldig mye in the dark, helt frem til at noe blir realisert. Og det jo et paradoks at investorene villige til å betale høyere, altså betale mer til forvalterne, til tross for at de har mindre innsyn. Det føler jeg I hvert fall det et paradoks. Men når det gjelder det som hun snakker om I intervjuet, så er det jo ikke dette primært, men hun snakker jo om skadevirkninger som hennes etterforskning eller undersøkelse, jeg vet ikke hva det kalles når det journalister som står bak, har avdekket om bransjen også, altså bruk av barnearbeid og I virkelig uhyggelig omgivelse for å si det på den måten. Så jeg synes det en balanse her, for dette har blitt veldig opphøyd, og mye som vi var inne på, kan vi takke, eller den industrien kan takke utviklingen som har vært I markedene, altså nemlig null til negative renter for, og det glemmer man veldig ofte, og man tror at de som driver denne bransjen alle alkemister. Det absolutt noen veldig, veldig flinke hoder I denne bransjen, men disse fond har jo poppet opp som, som badehatter de senere årene. Og på toppen er de lettere regulert enn for eksempel hedgefond, som de befinner, altså her er det belånte fond, eller i hvert fall belåning man bruker, og det er det samme i hedgefondindustrien. Forskjellen er at hedgefond er under et mye strengere regime, både når det gjelder å vise verdsettelser og likviditet. Så jeg føler jo at dette er en sånn, vi har jo snakket om det, dette er ganske lenge, men jeg synes det er bra å få noen som da, eller en tredjepart, og i dette tilfellet en Pulitzer-vinner, som da kikker på den industrien og gir et mer balansert inntrykk. Så jeg synes det var veldig bra. Jeg gleder meg til å lese boken også.
Skal jeg bare gå i gang med intervjuet da?
Ja, og la lytterne få høre hennes budskap.
You've been a senior financial reporter at NBC News Investigations. You worked at Forbes, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. I also believe that you started your career as a stockbroker.
Yes, that's right.
And you're, of course, a Pulitzer Prize winner. And now you've published a book, These Are the Plunderers, How Private Equity Runs and Wrecks America.
Right.
How did you end up in such a topic? Because private equity, in some ways, even though it's so big, it's almost never talked about.
That's right. One of the reasons that I thought this was a really important topic is because I try to always find out what's going on beneath the surface or behind the curtain to try to help explain to really everyday people, whether they're investors, consumers, pensioners, what's going on financially in the world that will have an impact on them. And as you rightly say, there is so much about private equity, this business, that is hidden from view. It's really been a very stealthy takeover of huge sectors of the American economy. And so what I hope to do with this book was to explain this takeover, this stealth takeover, to people so they know what's happening. Now, there's not a lot that you can do, but at least educating people about what's going on and how it is impacting them is important.
In your perspective, what is private equity? And like, how did it start? And how did it become so incredibly big? And also, why do you think that something so important isn't being talked about? It's not being written about in the news. It's not really talked about on CNBC. And like, the dynamic is so unique. Can you explain it from your perspective?
Okay, well, that's a lot in one question. So I'll take the last one first and then remind me if I forget any of your other questions. But why it's not talked about? You know, this is a problem with American journalism that really does occur in other industries. But many financial journalists in the U.S. are really sort of impressed with the deal makers. There's a kind of an obsession with deals, with transactions, with acquisitions, you know, mergers in the American financial press. And it really sort of hypes the deal makers. And it hypes the, you know, the sort of ecosystem surrounding these deals, but it never really delves into the impact that these deals have on regular people, whether they be the workers at the companies being taken over, the pensioners, the customers. And so it's a fact, really, that I find quite puzzling about my colleagues in journalism in the U.S., but it is basically an acceptance and even a celebration, as it were, of these deal makers. And so you don't have a lot of critical reporting on what the impact of these deals really are to people like you and me. And that's a flaw in our reporting system. And I don't know what you do about it, but I think that you just have to try to have you. I try to make my reporting different so that people understand the full scope of the impact of these acquisitions and these deals. So it's sort of a celebration of the wealthy, the deal makers, the Wall Street titans. It's that kind of a reporting stance that I really don't take, but that many, many others do. And that may be at least a partial explanation. There's also the fact, Sverre, that a lot of these transactions involve companies that are being taken private. Excuse me, private. And that means that there's less information about them than if they were public. And so it is tougher to get at some of the outcomes and some of the details about what happens after an acquisition. But it still is an important task. And that was what I was trying to do here. Now, the kind of private equity that I'm talking about in this book is really a sort of the prime movers in the industry, the very big firms, the largest, most well-known. Most of them are publicly traded now, that use a tremendous amount of debt in these acquisitions and that hope to flip the companies, i.e. sell them at a profit, in between 5 and 7 years. And so that's the business model that I'm talking about. And the firms that I'm focusing on are Apollo Global Management, Carlyle Group, Blackstone, KKR. And so you have these very, very large firms, very powerful, doing a lot of acquisitions over many, many years. And those are the ones that I'm really focusing on. There are smaller private equity firms that do not use as much debt. And so they have a different business model. If they put equity into a company, that's kind of a different thing. So this is really the very leveraged transactions using a lot of debt that look for a quick turnaround. And this industry really started back in the 70s. And you had, I think, the first big transaction that people would recognize as a private, a sort of precursor to the private equity deal maker world was the RJR Nabisco transaction that occurred in the late 1980s. And that was KKR at the time. And there was a fantastic book written about it called Barbarians at the Gate by Brian Burrow and John Hellyer. And it was really the first of these transactions that got people's attention because it was so massive. And you had, you know, US Congress was interested in whether these transactions were going to be good or bad for the economy, for workers. And so there was a flurry of interest in leveraged buyouts, as they were called at the time. But then they just sort of, you know, dropped the ball. This is not uncommon in Congress. And these guys were off to the races and the transactions multiplied. And so we now have, you know, 35 years later, a tremendous industry that controls, I think, 7% of the workforce in the United States. You have an industry that controls 40% of the nation's emergency departments in hospitals, at least 11% of nursing homes. And so it's just been a tremendous growth, partly because of easy money, low interest rates, but a tremendous growth that has been fueled by pension investors, public pensions that have invested with these massive private equity firms.
You talk about debt. Debt is a very important
part of this whole equation. And we've seen debt rise this year, and both in all forms, the rates are going up. Smart money are talking about a permanent shift potential, maybe higher for longer and for very much longer. And we can maybe say goodbye to the low rate, easy money times of the last 35, 40 years, depending on how you define it. Do you think that, like the famous quote, it's even in our intro in the podcast, do you think that they mistook leverage for genius?
Well, you know, Sphere, it's always easy to think that you're brilliant when prices are going up and your transactions are multiplying and, you know, you're being celebrated in the business press and you're becoming multi-billionaires in the process. So, yes, it's very easy to look at all of that, all those outcomes, and say, yes, I must be incredibly smart and, you know, look at me. But yes, we're starting to see, I think, cracks in the foundation of that concept. So we're starting to see bankruptcies in private equity owned companies. We're starting to see the fact that private equity firms can no longer sell their companies quickly at a profit in the 5 to 7 year period that I mentioned earlier. We're starting to see they can't sell them, for instance, in an IPO on the public stock market. So yes, the foundation is starting to crack. It's still uncertain whether it will have a significant impact on these firms. But yes, we are starting to definitely see a change in the economics for these firms, and therefore a change in their prospects. But one of the things that is quite central to the question of whether they will continue to dominate as they have is whether pension funds like CalPERS, CalSTRS, these major pension funds who've invested in private equity so deeply in recent years, whether they start to realize that the funds that they're investing in are not generating the returns that they need for their obligations. So for years, private equity did deliver alpha. They did deliver outsized returns, but no longer. The returns have now reverted to the mean, or sort of an S&P 500 index return, if even that. And so when you look at these private equity investments and all of the risks that they entail, such as illiquidity, not being able to sell, high costs, opacity, you don't know what you own exactly, how long you're going to be able to own it. When you see all of those risks, and then you start to see that the return is really that of an S&P 500 fund that costs 6 basis points, then you really hope that the massive pension funds would rethink their strategy of investing in this business, which I really consider to have an unsustainable business model.
It's interesting that you bring up pension funds, because in the very recent couple of weeks, I think, the head of the Norwegian sovereign fund, the oil fund, has said that he is looking at the PE sector as a possible new asset class to maintain the returns that they are looking for. Currently, their mandate is stock, bonds, and some real estate. It's been not talked about much. People, and I think partly it's because people don't really understand when he says, yeah, PE funds might be a good idea. And this is a former hedge fund manager. He's personally very wealthy. People kind of, I guess, assume that, yeah, maybe it's a good idea. What do you think about arguably the largest investor in the world entering at this time the PE space.
I think I should send him a copy of my book. Maybe you can give me his address.
A few people there listen to this podcast, so
I think this is the absolutely wrong time to be investing in private equity. I think that it is an unsustainable business model because of the heavy debt that is used to make these acquisitions happen, A, and B, because of the short time frame, the 5 to 7 year flip time frame that they want to achieve. So those two elements put a lot of pressure on the company. And, you know, that's what I think makes it unsustainable. And so you could, to me, investing in private equity is investing in a business that slashes workers, that slashes pensions, that oftentimes, you know, by companies that are in the, you know, polluting businesses, fossil fuels, et cetera, but also that really do not serve their customers well. There's an amazing study that showed that private equity owned nursing homes, and this was a very respected group of academics from UPenn, NYU, University of Chicago, found that at nursing homes owned by private equity, they had mortality rates that were 10% higher than mortality rates at nursing homes that were not owned by private equity. So you had 20,000 people die at these nursing homes because private equity cut staffing, they cut expenses, they cut costs to try to, you know, make their profits look better. And so therefore enable them to sell the company later at a profit. And yet the cost was 20,000 lives. So I would say that when people think about investing in private equity, you have to really think about what this business model requires managers of these companies to do. Now, for instance, I would say to the head of the sovereign wealth fund there, you know, perfect example of, I think, a very bad optic was the revelation earlier this year that Blackstone, perhaps the most prestigious private equity firm in the U.S., owns a company that was hiring children to clean slaughterhouses at night in the Midwest. Many were immigrants. They were children, 13 years old, 14 years old. It's illegal to do that in the United States, not to mention immoral. But in any case, so this company, which is owned by Blackstone, was found by the United States government, the Department of Labor, to have hired over 100 children to clean slaughterhouses. You know, an ugly, brutal, filthy, dangerous business. And so you want to know why a pension fund would invest in a company that has that kind of a business model. And I actually called CalPERS because CalPERS owns the Blackstone Fund. CalPERS is the huge California public employee retirement system, biggest pension in the United States. It's a leader in pension investing. Many smaller pensions follow its lead and invest where it does. Anyway, it's a big, huge investor in private equity. They happen to own the Blackstone Fund that holds the company that cleans the slaughterhouses. Now, Blackstone says they didn't know they were hiring children. The company says that it didn't know it was hiring children. Now, keep in mind, Blackstone had three members of the board, three of its people on the board. But, you know, I asked CalPERS, are you rethinking the idea of investing with Blackstone, given that this terrible story has come out about them hiring children to clean slaughterhouses? And CalPERS declined to comment. So you really have to understand what you're buying. And that's a big part of the issue with private equity, is that you're sort of just taking a gamble on what the firm will do, what it will own, how it will operate these companies. And the pressure points that I mentioned earlier, the heavy debt and the need to flip them at a profit in such a short period of time, really, really makes it difficult to run a company in a way that benefits all the other stakeholders, such as customers and workers and pensioners.
So you mentioned non-obvious investments, a few here. When people consider investments, you don't think nursing homes as the first. So in your book, you talk about some of the non-obvious investments that PE funds make, like things like, at least in Norway, you would consider to be infrastructure, something that's not investable. What are some of the most outrageous things you've seen as investments?
Well, the outrage to me, Sver, comes when you have bad outcomes for everyone but the private equity firm. And so I think the worst example that we've seen and that is in the book is the example of the aluminum smelter in Missouri that was called Noranda. It was a very high producing aluminum smelter on the banks of the Mississippi River. It had a large customer base. It was profitable. It was the biggest employer in this small town of New Madrid, Missouri, in a poor section of the state, not wealthy. They employed 2,500 people, very big. The town was small. And so this was the largest employer. And as the largest employer, it was also the largest contributor to the town's well-being in the tax base. Okay. So Noranda was the largest, for instance, taxpayer that supported the school system. So Apollo Global Management, which was then run by Leon Black, buys Noranda, they immediately pile on immense amounts of debt so that the company begins to struggle almost immediately. They get their money out. In fact, Apollo gets three times their money out with this debt that they put on the company. They extract cash from the debt that they require Noranda to take on. They then start laying people off because the debt is so, you know, towering that they can't make their payments. They start to lay people off. They then start to try to negotiate with the state utility commission to lower their electricity rates to try to make their, you know, profits better. Right, to try to stem the losses. The losses, by the way, coming from the debt that Apollo put on the company. So they try to get a lower tax, a lower utility rate on their electricity. It's obviously a very big user of electricity. Then they continue with layoffs. They finally get the utility commission in Missouri to agree to a decline in their rate, in their electricity rate. But it meant that all the other ratepayers in the state would have to pick up the difference. So Apollo, a multi-billion dollar, very wealthy firm, gets a break on the electricity cost of this plant while everyone else has to pay to pick up the difference. And finally, it goes bankrupt. And the school system loses an enormous portion of its revenues. School teachers have to pay their own health insurance. And children go without books because of this. 2,500 people laid off. Company goes bankrupt. Apollo walks away with three times its money. But you have left behind a plant that's in bankruptcy. Oh, and I almost forgot. There were three pensions associated with the Noranda plant that also went bankrupt. And so United States taxpayers had to pick up the obligations for those pensions because they were backed by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a U.S. entity that backs corporate pensions. So this is what I talk about when I talk about the circle of pain. The circle of pain in this case was vast. It included school children, teachers, workers, pensioners, even utility payers, even electricity customers in Missouri were in the circle of pain. But Apollo walked away with three times its money. And so that's what I believe people need to examine when they look at private equity deals. Who's on the other side of the transaction? Are they winning or are they losing? Many times they're losing. And that just tells me that this business model is really ill-suited to this time when we need to have workers who can make a living wage. We need to have pensioners who can rely on their retirement. And we certainly can't have the creation of multi-billionaires at the expense of people like these.
So if you look back, like from John Pierpont Morgan in, I think it was 1901 when he did the first LBO in history, and then 1946, which I guess was the first sort of PE firm, and then when it really took off in the 80s, it can't be all bad, is it? So for the sake of balance, can you think of some times it's been a good thing?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. I think I mentioned earlier, it's the heavy debt load that really does make this pernicious most of the time. So if you have a private equity firm that actually uses equity, that actually puts its own skin in the game, then that's a different story. And then you will have situations where they will benefit from behaving in a more sort of equal way, in caring more about customers, caring more about workers, etc. It's really this business model of the private equity firm puts down a tiny fraction of the money needed to make the transaction. And so therefore, even if it fails, they don't really have a cost associated with the failure. Like in the Noranda example, the company went bankrupt. Many people were on the losing end of the transaction, but Apollo, who did it, won, and they won big time. So if you have firms that are putting in equity, that's different. And yes, they are providing the necessary resources, money, financing for a company to grow. That's excellent. And that has great positive benefits for all concerned, workers, pensioners, you know, customers, etc. There are private equity deals that do make money for the pension funds that have invested in them. That's obviously a good thing, but it is happening less and less. The returns are becoming more and more modest. And so that's a question. I actually asked the lobbying organization for the private equity industry in the US to provide me with their list of best transactions, transactions that they felt really, you know, exemplified what private equity does, which they think is positive. And so they provided me with a list of about, I think about five or six. And, you know, one of them was Hilton Hotels, which was a big Blackstone deal that it made money for the firm and, you know, did not decimate the company. So there are certainly examples of companies that are helped and that work out well. But it is not clear to me that those examples outweigh the negative ones. And in fact, I asked Blackstone. They had actually been engaging with me. Of course, I went to them to ask for their comments and for interviews with them ahead of publication of my book. And I gave them the thesis, you know, that private equity is harming the economy with these kinds of transactions. And they said, of course, we disagree with that. And they said, our companies do not go bankrupt at the rate that, you know, others do. And we have actually hired, we've created jobs. We have hired people. We have not slashed jobs. And so I said, well, that's fantastic. Please provide me with the data. They said, we have created 200,000 net new jobs over the past 15 years at our companies, portfolio companies. I said, great, send me the data. I'd love to check that, verify it. And they refused. So it's very hard to get actual data from these companies that supports their view that they are actually helping the economy, not hurting it.
How do you think this will shake out, like long term? Is this just how business is, like forever? Or the debt load, will it eventually wreck the firms and sort of change it? What do you think the next 30 years are going to look like? Just LBO after LBO until one firm owns everything?
Well, you know, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S., is starting to go after some of these transactions. So that might change things a little bit. Mergers and acquisitions have been allowed to go on with really very little in the way of government intervention, even though market power and monopolization has increased with these transactions, particularly in healthcare. So I don't know what my crystal ball is telling me, but I do know that the debt problem of high interest rates or higher rates for longer, as you noted at the outset of the call, that these that will have an impact. And we're already starting to see it with bankruptcies, but these don't affect the firms. They affect the portfolio companies in their funds. And as I said earlier, they only put a tiny amount of their own money into these funds. So it really will have an impact more on the owners, like the pension funds, for instance.
Ironically, if they would change the structure to be more like the much criticized hedge fund industry, where it's very common for the firm and the asset manager to have maybe 10% stake in the fund, or and often it's demanded, if they would just change that, would that just fundamentally change how the industry works in your perspective?
Yes.
If they did that one change.
That one change. Also, if we could get rid of the tax loophole that allows these people to pay far lower taxes on the value of their holdings in their funds, that would also change their behavior immediately. But yes, so hedge funds, you know, and hedge fund managers that do poorly, they pay the price.
Exactly.
But these people, they don't pay the price.
But hedge funds are criticized in the press daily, often used as a sort of byword for greedy capitalism. But in my personal experience, it's the people with the most skin in the game, at least on average.
in terms of asset classes.
Yeah. If you really want to look at greed at work, it's really the private equity industry. It's not hedge funds. I mean, hedge funds are in there with their clients. Private equity firms have very, very, very small investments alongside their customers. So I think it's a complete apples and oranges situation.
Finally, I took a look at some of your reviews. You've gotten excellent reviews. And I found someone on Amazon who didn't like the book. He called it a hit
probably,
job.
Probably in the private equity industry.
Almost. He called it a hit job. So I Googled his name, and he was a lawyer in a firm whose areas of practice include mergers and acquisitions, antitrust, real estate, corporate litigation, and tax. Is that a satisfying bad review?
Yes. No, I mean, the people who are critical, I'm fine with criticism, and I welcome it because it always makes my reporting better for me to understand what the other side is saying. But, you know, you have to acknowledge where your biases are. And if you're a lawyer who's recommending, who's doing deal making, then of course that's where you're going to come down on the side of it, saying that this is a hit job. It's not a hit job. It's trying to educate people about what's going on in a very stealthy, very powerful, very money profit oriented business. That's all.
I think also you pinpointed some important points. Like, it is possible to do this in a good way. And I think that the Norwegian PE industry, which is far less extreme than the American one, and also it's shorter time, so I bet that it's going to be harder to find examples for a follow-up book here. Also, the regulations are tighter. I'm not sure exactly because it's so opaque, but generally here we see more like buying large, for instance, oil services firm or things like that. Not things that affect sort of like you talk about nursery home. Yeah, exactly. So it is just business people doing business. And I think that fundamentally is a very different thing.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, if you're a customer of a nursing home and you don't know who owns it, and if it's private equity owned, then you should know that the mortality rate at private equity owned nursing homes is far higher than at other firms. People don't know that. And so that's important for customers to know. And so in these areas like healthcare, where it's really a common good we're talking about, we're not talking about widgets. We're not talking about making a company more efficient at making widgets. We're talking about caring for people in their most vulnerable moments. And that's where you really have to question when the profit motive gets to be so distilled and so important.
Thank you so much for taking time to explain this opaque industry and shedding some lights on the darker parts of it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your interest. And Norwegians are my people.
Are you of Norwegian descent?
Yes, I am.
That's very nice. Do you know where in the country?
Yes, except I'm forgetting the name of the
probably
town.
Bergen.
Let's see. I don't know. It's a very small town, and I went to visit it once, and I should have it right off the top of my head, but I'm sorry I don't. It's on the western, near Bergen.
No, there's a lot of former Norwegians in America.
I know.
But thank you so much.
Thank you, and I really wish you luck with your podcast. It sounds like you're very, very good at your job and delving in very deeply on important topics.
Thank you.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.